Anthony Lowenstein joins me, author, journalist, Guardian columnist, blogger, documentary maker, fairly regular guest on this show. Thanks so much for your time this morning, Anthony.
Thanks for having me.
I kind of hate to ask you to do a wrap-up of the year, but I am going to. Because over this year we've spoken about a whole range of issues like drone strikes, citizen arrests, protests, how Australia has gone to war and whether it's in fact legal that Australia is at war. It's been a pretty interesting year politically. What do you think are some of the significant moments from this year for you? What have you focused on?
Well, I guess anyone who follows the news either locally or internationally couldn't exactly end the year on a very optimistic note, could they? I mean, that's pretty much the bottom line. We have war raging across the Middle East. We have a failing war against ISIS. We have a civil war in Syria. Israel-Palestine yet again or continuously is in conflict. Much of the Middle East is also unstable, Libya, Egypt. Closer to home in Australia, look, I think one level, I think there is sometimes a mistake that many people on the left make that saying the Abbott government's been a disaster. In terms of our views, they've been a disaster, but and a lot of the polls suggest that Abbott is not doing very well, which makes me very happy. A lot of things that they've said they want to do, they've done. And in fact, just by the end of this year, this month, the Abbott government's pushed through some pretty extreme asylum seeker policy, backed, I might add, by elements in the Palmer United Party, Ricky Muir and a few other people. These are really extreme policies, and the power, there was a piece in The Guardian recently talking about how it pretty much makes Scott Morrison, the immigration minister, arguably the most powerful minister in the government, because it essentially allows him to play God over individuals who come, individuals who go. And I think it really shows that there is one of the great tragedies of Australia this year, but that I would have said that last year or indeed in years past, is there really is no opposition. So regardless of who's actually in power, Labor or Liberal, we really have a one-party system, and I'd say this about the US and the UK as well. I mean, Chomsky often says that the US really is a one-party state with two business ends of the same party, and I think he's right. I'd say exactly the same thing here. Yes, of course there are differences between Labor and Liberal, and yes, there are certain things that Labor wouldn't do that Abbott is doing. So I'm not saying everything is the same. For example, I think although Labor was in some ways increasingly privatising the healthcare system, the Liberals are accelerating that far more, and I'd say the same about the higher education policy that Pine hasn't got through yet, but I fear we'll get through in some form in 2015. But having no opposition makes so many issues so much more difficult, because it really relies on a media to do their job, and with some notable exceptions, they mostly don't.
Do you think, though, in Australia there is appetite for something other than a two-partied system? We just recently had the Victorian state election here. The Greens did pretty well, and they, you know, gave Labor a scare in a couple of seats. They got in Melbourne. Do you think this country, like, you know, Europe, could move towards a more inclusive government?
Well, I'd like to say yes to that, and I guess in terms of 10 years ago, you have the Greens, who, of course, as you rightly say, have done pretty well. I mean, the last federal election, they did relatively okay, but you wouldn't say they did amazingly well. In fact, their support nationally fell. Victoria, as you said, they did quite well. There's a New South Wales election in 2015. The Greens have a very good chance of winning some seats in the lower house that they don't currently have. That's all very important. The issue, I think, at the moment with really having a more powerful third party, whether it's the Greens or, for that matter, some other organisation, is how do you get traction to do that? How do you get organisation to do that? And if you look, as you rightly say, in the US, there's no real good example of a third party. In the UK, there are two recent examples, in fact, and both are pretty awful. The Liberal Democrats are currently in government with the Tories, and in the 2015 election, they're going to be absolutely slaughtered. Everyone I speak to says the Lib Dems are destroyed because of their collusion with the Tories. The other party, of course, is UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, under the kind of buffoonish Nigel Farage, who are doing unbelievably well. They're very popular. People like they're pretty right-wing, not mad right, but pretty extreme right-wing, very anti-immigration, quite homophobic in ways as well. And they have tapped into a vein of thought in England that makes people very uncomfortable about immigrants, and that has forced Labor and the Tories to go further to the right. And I think the possibility of some kind of similar party here is definitely possible. So more on the right than the left. The Greens obviously are on the left. But I think the difficulty is also the ability to get serious and respectful media coverage. I mean, in Australia, you have really a Murdoch press that fundamentally loathes the Greens. And Murdoch himself has said that the aim should be to destroy them as a party. Now, obviously, he hasn't succeeded in that. And I think there's obviously been problems with some of the Greens' policies as well. I mean, not saying the Greens are beyond criticism. They should be scrutinised like anybody else. But I think a serious third party in Australia without a serious base and organisational structure to do so, and not just appeal, I might add, to any inner city whiteies like you and me, is a problem. And the Greens, I think, sadly, haven't done very well in the last years in really expanding their base beyond that. Of course, there's Green support beyond the inner city. There is, to be sure. And one of the things in the last few years with their really important campaigns against CSG has massively increased their support in the more sort of national party areas. But that's still pretty white. And I think the failure of elements of the Greens to really get a foothold in the more ethnic communities, in the asylum seeker communities, is a problem. I know a lot of Greens who'd like to change that, and some of them are trying, but I'm not suggesting that they're doing particularly well in it.
Will it be a change in something like these migration laws, which I've spoken to David Mann about today as well, will it take something like that to sort of galvanise people in Australia, do you think?
You know, we always wonder, don't we, what is it going to take? What is it going to take, Michelle, to get people angry enough to do something, to really not just go to a rally, assuming they do that anyway, not just maybe write an article for The Guardian like I do, or do something else? I mean, I've said for a while, I think we talked about this on the show this year, that when policies get so appalling, so extreme, so out of the bounds of acceptable policy, that there needs to be something discussed about, say, sanctions. And there's no public support at the moment for that, apart from a few people that I speak to. But the idea of at least raising the conversation of, say, a sporting boycott. Now, I'm not talking about a full country boycott, but I can guarantee you if there was a discussion about a sporting boycott, you would have people in apoplexy in this country, which is exactly why it should happen. To have a discussion about it, to at least raise it, to at least suggest that our immigration policy at the moment, which Morrison successfully, I have to say, got through the parliament last week, now gives him, as I said before, godlike powers beyond the reach often of national law and international law, should mean that people are incredibly angry. But I think one of the things that I've discovered, Michelle, I've written about this issue really in some ways for more than a decade, is you can't underestimate the way that a lot of Australians, and I'd say the same in the UK, the US, parts of Europe, and the anti-immigration sentiment in Europe, as we know, is surging, including in countries that used to be very left-wing, including in Scandinavia. That myth of Scandinavian countries all being very left really is shifting in the last 5 years, sadly. But you can't underestimate the effect that every day a lot of Australians are hearing that all immigrants are terrorists or they're a threat. You hear this every day for years, and a lot of people believe it. They believe it. And how you change that, I have no simple answer to that, of course, but you need to almost re-educate people instead of saying that all the obvious facts for the majority of immigrants who come to the country are legitimate, 90%, you know, are granted citizenship, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All those kind of facts are there, and yet you have a barrage of media crap, of course, often saying the opposite. That, I think, is what we're dealing with here, and changing that is bloody difficult.
And of course, this year has seen a huge sort of conflation of this idea that whatever's happening with ISIS or overseas is all about immigration in Australia.
Mm.
Talk about that, Anthony. I mean, that's sort of been, it's kind of been unbelievable. We talk about unfettered power. Look at the powers that our government now has with counterterrorism laws, and the fact that they've sort of been pushed through on this threat of we've got to, you know, look after our own and Operation Sovereign Borders.
Absolutely. Well, look, the war against ISIS, which I might add is failing miserably. I mean, the media doesn't talk about this very much, but If you look at a lot of the Middle Eastern press, the Arabic press, and indeed some of the more critical US and British press, really has shown that the kind of people and organisations that Australia, America, Britain are partnering with in Iraq and Syria are exactly the kind of people who are committing the crimes. I'm not suggesting they're in bed with ISIS, but we're in bed with groups who are just as bad. Just as bad. In fact, there was an interesting piece in Foreign Policy magazine last week online saying how, which has not got much press, that all this glorious humanitarian bombing we keep on reading about that Obama's leading in Syria and Iraq are killing so many civilians. So many civilians. So the idea somehow that by doing that, we're going to make friends with the right kind of people who then are desperate for us to save them from what ISIS or from the appalling Iraqi regime is just delusional. And in fact, it's made worse by the fact that, as you rightly say, most of the press in Australia here blindly buys the argument that we are under threat by ISIS. Now, ISIS are a horrible organisation. They're run by horrible people, many of whom, I might add, used to be backed by the US, but minor detail we don't really want to talk about. And ISIS is something which is really a result of countless years of US policy in Iraq. I mean, people don't often talk about this, but much of the leadership of ISIS is former Saddam loyalists, and the head of ISIS, Baghdadi, was in an American jail in Iraq for years and tortured for doing so. Now, I'm not saying he's tortured by the Americans, therefore he forms ISIS. Of course, it's more complicated than that. But you see in Syria, just moving to Syria briefly, that there are at the moment reports that Syrian rebels, these are the rebels that we're apparently always hearing about, the freedom fighters that America is so desperate to support, as Australia is, they're essentially partnering up with Al-Qaeda in Syria because they're so pissed off with the fact that America is bombing their own people, their civilians. I mean, this is what you don't read about because there's virtually no journalists there, because the country is so dangerous that very few journalists, rightly so, go there. It's just simply too dangerous to go. So, you know, go there. You know, the risk of kidnapped by ISIS or God knows what group is a real risk. I mean, you know, we all know the images this year of aid workers and journalists who have their heads chopped off on camera. It's just absolutely ludicrous what's happening over there. But I think that in Australia, we're so easily believing the fear that if we believe that the Muslim Arab world is this homogenous threat, and that when the US president declares war on this homogenous ISIS group and we simply blindly follow, that we almost wonder why, yes, is a threat increase in Australia? Absolutely, because of our own actions. I mean, that last part of the sentence, Michelle, is what's never talked about. Of course there's a threat here. Yes, there's a threat, and many people, friends of mine in the Muslim community, are petrified about the possibility of some terrorist attack happening in Australia committed by a Muslim. We all know, I mean, that'd be horrible for self-evident reasons, but it's horrible because we know how the Australian government and various forces in Australia would react to the Muslim community. It's already appalling. It's already discriminatory and full of racism. Can you imagine if something actually happens here? And many of us fear that is almost inevitable at some point.
And the cynical among us might look at some of the situation of Australia's involvement there as a push to get Tony Abbott out of the depths of the polls that he was in at that time.
Yep. That sort of hasn't happened, and domestic concerns, things like just the basics of getting through a budget that is fundamentally unfair to the majority of Australians, has in fact taken over the news of whatever's happening over in Iraq at the moment.
Well, look, certainly initially the ISIS mission did help Abbott and the government. There was definitely a boost in support, but that seems like old history now, doesn't it? I mean, here we are at the end of the year, and an incredibly lame and Me Tooism Labor, possibly, if there was an election today, would win. But the election is 2 years away. You know, it's a lifetime. It is a lifetime away. And is Shorten even going to be leader then? Is Abbott even going to be leader then? I mean, now we have history in Australia, right, in the last 10 years. Leaders and prime ministers can be changed within the term of government. I'm not saying Abbott's going to get replaced, but if the polls keep on staying so bad, nothing's impossible, right? Nothing is impossible. Who knows?
Well, let's hope.
Let's hope. And to be replaced by whom?
Well, or, you know, all of a sudden we're in the midst of talking about the Treasurer and what's going to happen there and when that's going to change.
Indeed. And, I mean, I think one of the things, hopefully, that has taught many people on the faux left this year, Michelle. Anyone says to me that Malcolm, if only Malcolm Turnbull was our Prime Minister, if only Malcolm was in charge, people like Turnbull are put up as if only someone like him on a range of human rights issues would actually be better. But let's look just very quickly what's happened this year. Key supporter of greater intelligence powers, key supporter of data retention, key supporter of metadata changes, key supporter of cutting ABC and SBS. I mean, this is a company man from way back, and it's a sad state of, I guess, Australian politics that someone like that, and I have this very clearly etched in my mind, opened and launched the Saturday paper this year, that kind of cosy, if only there was a sort of a nice Labor left in power, which of course is never going to happen because they don't actually exist in practice, or for that matter, someone like Turnbull. I mean, look at what they do rather than what they say. It's pretty obvious, right? And yet it strikes me time and time and time again. I think last month's cover of the monthly magazine was Tanya Plibersek. Now, there's an element within the left, the kind of mainstream left, call it whatever you want, Michelle, who sort of idealises something that doesn't actually exist, a kind of Labor left that hasn't existed for, what, 30, 40 years? Or, for that matter, a kind of Liberal wing of the Liberal Party. There are Liberals in the Liberal Party, to be sure. Absolutely there are. And I'm not saying that Malcolm Turnbull's Cory Bernardi. But when it comes down to it, ultimately, look at what Turnbull has done this year. I mean, the results speak for themselves. So if that's the kind of person...
Well, I think one of the most interesting things that he did too was try to explain the fact that Tony Abbott hadn't broken an election promise when he promised to not cut our public broadcaster. I mean, you mentioned earlier the Murdoch press loathing the Greens, and there's something they probably loathe even more than that, and that is our public broadcasters in this country.
Indeed, indeed. And look, this year has been a barrage, an absolutely daily barrage. I read the Australian newspaper every day for work, and it has been an unbelievable campaign against the ABC, and in some ways, you have to say, pretty successful. Pretty successful. The year ends with large ABC and SBS budget cuts. Journalists are going to be fired. Some of them are being fired. Listeners will be aware there's kind of this crazy process inside of the ABC now where certain journalists and producers have to kind of prove to their superiors why they should stay. It's an appallingly managed system, which I do note that Sarah Ferguson, to her great credit at the Walkleys last week, made a comment about that. She's in a position, I guess, of such strength, not likely to fire Sarah Ferguson. That would be insane. She was really critical of how the ABC has managed that, and I thought that was really brave of her to do that, considering she's an employee of the ABC. But the Murdoch press has had this relentless campaign against the ABC, and ultimately I had a piece in The Guardian about this a few weeks ago. When they constantly say we believe in public broadcasting, it's really bollocks. What they want, like you see in the UK and the US, is such a nobbled public broadcaster with no real influence or power. And the idea somehow that you increasingly sell off various arms of a public broadcaster. So yes, maybe some of it kind of exists in years to come, but none of it competes with your own outlets. And that's an absurd idea somehow, that we should believe in the democracy that a Murdoch press or a Fairfax press, or for that matter a Guardian, I mean, any organisation should have competition. That's the nature of a freer country. Now, we don't live in a one media organisation country, although you'd be hard-pressed to see that in some states, right? But there needs to be diversity of views. It's an obvious thing to say. And the Murdoch press says they believe in that, but in fact the reality is that they hate the idea. The ABC is not just competing with them, but in fact on public trust leaves them for debt, and they know that.
And also on just simple things like innovation and owning the online world in terms of news and,
for sure,
you know, all of those sorts of things. Well, Anthony Lowenstein, you are one independent voice in Australia that I've very much valued having on the show over the last year or so. Thank you so much for your time this year.
My pleasure. It's been great coming on. I look forward to more in 2015.
Yeah, look forward to that. Thanks heaps, Anthony. We'll speak with you soon.
Michelle.